Case number two, come on up. 22-13798, Keith Stansel et al. Versus Samar Jose Lopez Bello et al. Okay, Mr. Fells, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Adam Fells on behalf of Lopez and the corporate defendants, Judges Jordan, Judge Brashear, Judge Abudu, fellow counsel, may it please the court. Mr. Lopez is not a terrorist. He is not an agency or instrumentality of the FARC, not directly, not indirectly, not even using the 6 degrees of separation of Kevin Bacon test that this court indicated in its last ruling was improper. All he has wanted to do is have a fair shake at defending the false allegations that he is an agency or instrumentality, be on a level.
He set for a deposition and just say that.
Sorry?
He wouldn't set for a deposition.
Your Honor, the discovery order that they claim is not a discovery order. What it is it is basically explaining you are not going to file any motions in this case. And I want to be very clear about that because there is some confusion about the language that was used, particularly in that last order on the 14th of October. He barred Lopez from seeking any relief from this court so long as his fugitive status persists. At that moment, he is depriving Mr. Lopez of his First Amendment rights to file a motion.
Before you even get to that, Mr. Fells, he had a deposition set, and twice he didn't show for it. There's, as far as I see in the record, there's no legitimate reason to not sit for it. What excuse can he possibly have? What legally valid reason can he have for not sitting for the deposition?
Your Honor, there are two instances. The first time they unilaterally set him, as we explained to the court, they did this in violation of Rule 26F.
Already addressed that and said this order allows for discovery. It identifies a provision in the rules that say unless authorized by the court. So I think the district court has already identified its order as a proper discovery order.
Well, and our concern, Judge Abudu, is that this was not a discovery order. What this was an injunction. And I understand that in the...
But what was an injunction?
Basically explaining to the litigant, you are not allowed to seek any relief, and I'm not going to consider any relief.
You're putting the cart before the horse, I think. That's a separate issue. But for that issue, to be able to show prejudice on that issue, I speak only for myself, you have to provide a valid reason that you were prevented from providing to the district court to get out of the deposition.
Okay. So,
and the way this record looks to me, this is Stansel 3 for me. And the way from 2014 to 2 years ago to now, and the way this record looks to me instinctively is he was never going to sit for the deposition.
Your Honor, I disagree, respectfully. And I have to point out that there is another case out that was filed after these briefings. It's the Marone case. And we are currently working through the discovery issues because we have a normal schedule. We're not being forced essentially to start, finish, object to, and conclude all discovery within 2 weeks, which is...
But you knew from the time we issued Stansel 2 that you were going to have to face the music at some point. And he was going to have to testify at some point. And he's given the option. If Judge Scola had ordered him to appear in Miami for deposition, that's a whole different ballgame. That's a whole different case. But he let him appear by Zoom. So what legal reason, legally valid reason, did he have for not sitting for the deposition?
Okay. So if we get the timeline, they unilaterally set him for deposition It was in person. That was an impossibility.
Fine.
We still moved for a motion for protective order. It was denied. And in that very first denial, the court says, I'm not going to consider your motion.
But he also granted it in part because he let him sit by Zoom. And he said, here's the date for you to do it.
He gave actually a range of a week.
Okay.
And essentially the other side.
What's the legally valid reason for not sitting for the deposition if you have a week to prepare?
Because, Your Honor, the problem is by the time we're asking, and we do, we ask for an additional 2 days because.
Why are those two days magical?
The two days were magical error. Because, Your Honor, this is the deposition of the defendant. We needed an opportunity to prepare
him. You've known since Stansel 2 that this was going to happen, that this was an inevitability. If he submits an affidavit, which we relied in part on in Stansel 2, to say that there are disputed issues of material fact on whether he's an agency or instrumentality of the FARC, you know. You can bet your bottom dollar that he is going to be set for deposition. So you've had months to talk to him, prep him, prepare him. Then he gets set for deposition, and then by Zoom, and he's like, no, not going to do it.
So, Your Honor, respectfully, the position that the plaintiffs took before the remand was no discovery in this case.
And they changed their mind because they were arguing no trial is needed. We're entitled to summary judgment. We agreed with you that there were material issues of fact and you were entitled to a jury trial.
Right. So the point is, it's not inevitable that there's going to be a deposition.
Of course there is.
Again, if they're taken at their word.
He files an affidavit that creates an issue of material fact. He is, in essence, the opposing party. He is a domino on which everything else falls. If he's an agency or instrumentality, then very likely all of his controlled companies are agencies or instrumentalities, and they get to execute. I still haven't heard a legal reason why he can't sit for the deposition when he was ordered to do so.
If the court had come back and said, I'm going to give you these 2 days. I understand your point. Maybe I'm going to back away slightly from what I said about you can't seek any sort of affirmative relief. He would have sat. He would have sat for the deposition.
How do we know that?
I'm making that representation because we're not going to ask.
But a representation like that can't be taken at face value, not because it's you making it, but because an affirmative representation about a question of fact made by a lawyer, which we can't accept one way or another. The only thing we have in the record is he was told to sit for deposition, he was allowed to sit by Zoom, and he didn't sit for it.
And Your Honor, the issue is, this was an impossibility. You cannot have a court order setting discovery on a matter like that. That itself was an error, and it's the Chudasama case all over again. And I actually would think that this case, the facts are worse than they were in Chudasama, because essentially this was an impossibility. And don't forget, one of the other things that we asked for in that second motion is, Your Honor, they are in violation of this case that we cited and in violation of the rules. They're asking us to accelerate the
violation
production documents.
Of what case?
Your Honor, it was a district court case that was, I believe it was a Judge Middlebrook's case that we cited. And we cited it in our second motion.
What proposition?
Proposition is that a litigant may not accelerate the period of time under Rule 34, the 30-day period, by noticing a subpoena deuces tecum. And what Judge Middlebrook said.
But a district court has, generally speaking, the discretion to change those timelines.
Your Honor, I agree with that. If what the court had done is said, I'm not mentioning fugitive disentitlement doctrine. I'm not going to say that at all. What I'm going to do is analyze. I'm going to hear your motion, and I'm going to analyze it. Then there's no First Amendment issue. There's no due process issue because he's making, a decision based on the merits of the motion. But that's not what this court did. Respectfully, what he did was make a blanket prohibition going into the future, saying, I'm not going to consider any of your motions. That is a clear due process violation. It violates what the court's principle was laid out in Farron.
That doesn't matter at the end of the day, even if you're right, if the conduct that led to the default is the failure to sit for the deposition.
Well, the conduct that respectfully, the conduct that led to the default was the court's mismanagement of its trial schedule, just like in Chudasama, and its misapplication of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. I can say that if the court backs away and says, okay, extra 2 days, I did initially say it was within 7 day period, the 19th, if you sit on the 19th, I'm gonna give you that a 2 day extension. He would have sat. We would have figured out how to do it.
And that 2 day thing is what creates reversible error in this case.
What creates reversible error is what the court said after. Specifically, you are barred from seeking affirmative relief.
But that relief, if you say he would have sat, what affirmative relief could he have asked for the deposition 2 days later?
That is actually my point, because if he does sit after the court has ordered, you are barred from seeking affirmative relief. He can moot out his appeal. There's a long history in this case of mooting out even constitutional issues. And so if once he is ordered on the 14th, you can't file any more appeals. And by the way, I think it's important to say, we made very specific objections to some of the discovery requests. Judge didn't even entertain those issues. He didn't entertain our argument about the Rule 30, 34 acceleration. He did what you're not allowed to do under due process, which is just to say, I'm not gonna hear any of your motions. And by the way, not only am I not gonna consider them, you are barred from filing them in the future.
You said he would have sat.
Well, that obviously, if the judge the judge issues the order, I believe is on the 12th, saying
if he gives you the 2 days,
yes, and if he doesn't issue that order,
no, he gives you the 2 days, but he still issues the order saying you can't ask for any further affirmative relief.
That's a different story.
Does he sit?
No, I think is a different story, because you still have the constitutional issue.
What does the not filing anything else have to do with the sitting for the deposition?
Sure. So if he sits, let's say the number of issues come up, potential Fifth Amendment issue, potential, what did you talk with your lawyer? If I know I can't file a motion, You don't have to file a motion.
You instruct them not to answer.
But this is the same situation that you have.
And then they move to compel. And then you respond to the motion to compel. He asked an attorney-client privilege question. He invoked privilege. He can't ask that. Next.
Okay, and now if the judge says you're compelled to answer, now what?
That's no different than if you had filed the motion and he had ruled against you on the merits of the motion.
Well, except it is different because, again, he has a constitutional right to due process.
Yeah,
if
but
he
if
now
the judge,
sits
but
for
if,
that deposition, he waives that.
So he's not going to sit.
No, that's...
It's a conditional sitting. If you rule in my favor on the fugitive disentitlement affirmative relief stuff, I'll sit.
In other words, the point is, if he treats Mr. Lopez like any other civil defendant litigant, which is really the message of Farron, and I should point out, Farron includes a situation where you actually have a relation between the case in which he's a fugitive and not. And you don't have that, and I do want to get to that point because it's an important one. There was a factual finding that was wrong that even undermines the application of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. But the point is, once he makes the broad pronouncement, you can't file any more motions. That is a due process violation that really, at that point, we had a good faith basis. We needed to go to the 11th Circuit. We needed to not comply, because if we do, we wind up mooting the appeal. And I do want to point out, prior in the case, because you mentioned you've been involved in the case a long time, Judge Jordan, you may remember there was a piece of property that we moved the 11th Circuit to freeze the sale of that property. And the motion for the stay was denied. But you made a concurrent, you concurred in the opinion, but you did say, I think there's a due process violation here. What happens? We go up on appeal, we try to get some relief in reversing the sale, and the issue's mooted. So the point is, at that point, when the court makes this very broad pronouncement, unprecedented, unconstitutional, you can't file any motions, you can't defend yourself, you're gonna be with one arm tied behind your back or two arms tied behind your back throughout this litigation, we had to come to the court. Now, if the court had issued its order, if it backed off and said, you know what, I'm not gonna say you can't file any motions, I will consider your motions, but I'll give you the extra 2 days, now we're in a different posture. Because now he's not essentially saying you can never file a motion or ask
you
for anything.
You're linking those two things, and I'm not sure they're linkable. I'm not sure that the failure to sit is linked to the order preventing him from seeking affirmative relief. I think they're independent things.
Your Honor, I think if he is not, basically, if he's not even engaging us on the arguments, and that's very clear from the nature of the orders, he's not even considering the arguments, that itself is a violation, even if he doesn't say you can't file any motions. There's a number of cases on that.
But when a client sits for a deposition, you're not filing, you're not at your computer filing instantaneous motions with the judge, unless things are so bad that the district judge appoints a magistrate judge or a special master to sit. You're objecting, and then the other side says, okay, you know, we'll take it up with the judge if you're not going to answer that question, and you move forward. That happens in litigation.
It does, but what is unprecedented here, Your Honor, is it's clear from the judge's order and misapplication or misdefinition of the term affirmative relief, he's not listening to anything that we're saying. He won't allow us to say anything, and it extends even to objections. Because again, as I mentioned, in our second emergency motion for a protective order, we made a number of specific objections to the discovery request. He said, I'm not even considering them because you're a fugitive. And so under those circumstances, how can we sit for any deposition? We can't make an objection. We can't file a motion.
An objection is not affirmative relief.
But the court's conception from that order clearly shows that it is. Because again, we're saying, Your Honor, for example, these particular types of documents, these are not documents that can be turned over in discovery. These documents, the court doesn't have jurisdiction because it's from a different court. And did he address any of those points? No. He said, you're a fugitive. I'm not addressing these points.
Okay, Mr. Fells, we've taken you way over your time. You saved all of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rosenthal.
Good morning. May it please the court. Richard Rosenthal on behalf of the appellees. Your Honors, I would like to begin with Judge Jordan's series of questions to my brother at the bar, because Judge Jordan has been living with this case for over a decade, as well as I have, and so he knows it inside and out. And Judge Jordan, you're exactly right when you ask the question, what is the legitimate excuse for not sitting for this deposition? Is it linked to the fugitive disentitlement ruling, or was there any basis whatsoever? And I don't think you got a straight answer. And the truth is, there was no legitimate excuse for Mr. Lopez not to sit for the deposition.
Before you get there, I want you to, at some point during your time, address the district court's application of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine to the prohibition on Mr. Lopez seeking affirmative relief, which seems a little bit funky to me. If you're allowed to defend a case under FARO and the doctrine is not going to be applied to you to completely knock you out of court and have you lose the case, it's hard to see how you can properly defend without being able sometimes to ask for affirmative relief. Like, for example, this case, it couldn't have happened because we already ruled that summary judgment, but moving for summary judgment, for example, that just seems a little funky to me.
So this court has distinguished between throwing someone out entirely based on the fugitive disentitlement doctrine, the FDD, I call it throughout the brief, and limiting what they can do in terms of seeking some forms of affirmative relief. And you have my word, I will turn to that in greater detail, Judge Jordan, in a moment. But before I do that, let me just emphasize that the fugitive disentitlement doctrine, the ruling, the alternative basis for Judge Scola's holding, was just that, an alternative basis. I heard my brother at the bar say repeatedly from this podium that Judge Scola never entertained the merits of his arguments on the motions for protective order. That's simply not so. If you look at docket entries 523 and 527, you will see each time, and then on the default order 536, you will see Judge Scola entertaining every one of the merit-based arguments that he argued for a protective order. And Judge Scola said, there's no merit to this. These are baseless. I'm looking at these. In several instances, he said, I cannot even tell what the argument is that Mr. Lopez is asserting to not have to sit for depo or not have to answer these paper discoveries. I'm getting the answers from the opposing party. But in any event, I am engaging these arguments, and I am rejecting them on the merits. And as an alternative basis, The FDD gives me a reason not to entertain these arguments. So this was an entirely alternate basis for all of the rulings from Judge Scola. So really, the FDD, as we think it, is a sideshow.
Okay, so let's say that the FDD is a sideshow. Why isn't a default judgment for discovery violation not extreme? Why not just impose sanctions, require Mr. Lopez to provide attorney's fees for the amount of time wasted during discovery? I mean, again, if it's just on the protective order issue, it seems extreme to enter the default judgment.
It wasn't under the circumstances of this case, Your Honor. In an ordinary litigant, in an ordinary case, maybe you impose some sort of sanction, like you described, fine him. He has no funds that haven't been blocked by OFAC. There is no way to fine him anything. There is no way to threaten him with contempt. He's already a fugitive from justice, hiding out in Venezuela, a country with no extradition treaty. He is alleged by OFAC and by our experts to be in the inner circle of the Maduro regime. They are protecting him and coddling him. They are not going to turn him over. So it is an empty threat. There's nothing that Judge Scola could have done. And he made a factual finding, which is entitled to some deference from this court, saying, I have no other sanctions that would be effective. This court said in the Adolf Kors case and a number of other cases cited in our brief, it's not just alternative, less drastic sanctions that you can hypothesize that a district judge has to consider before imposing the death penalty, if you will. It's alternative sanctions that would be effective, that would secure compliance with his earlier orders and would serve as a sufficient deterrent to future litigants to not pull this sort of stunt. And Judge Scola acknowledges this, says, look, I need to consider other less drastic alternatives. Under the circumstances of this case, I find that nothing would be effective. He had warned him twice in written orders, in bold, in underline, if you do not show up for this depo, you will be sanctioned, including an up to dismissal of your case or of the claim. What's he going to do? There is nothing he could have done to secure this man's attendance. And I heard from the podium today, oh, we would have shown up on October 19th. With no disrespect to my very able counsel and brother at the bar, that is not what he said the day before the deposition and at the deposition. It's in the record, docket entry 531-4. He writes to us on October 16th, Mr. Lopez will not be appearing at any deposition until after the appeal is heard, end quote. Not, oh, we'll show up on the 19th if you drop the appeal or we can negotiate this. It was until our appeal is heard, and the appeal, by the way, from which there was no jurisdiction. It was essentially a baseless, frivolous appeal to give himself a fig leaf not to show up. We will not show up. He says the exact same thing at the deposition. Mr. Fells shows up on the Zoom. This is docket entry 532-1 at page 4, the October 17th deposition. He repeats the exact same statement. Lopez will not be appearing at any deposition until the appeal is heard, end quote. So this notion that he was going to show up 2 days later is a myth.
But it does perhaps suggest that he would be willing to show up at some time. He's just trying to put conditions in terms of the timeline.
In any event, it would have been a violation of both of Judge Scola's orders. So he doesn't get to make up his own rulings. Judge Scola has issued two orders. And by the way, there was a third violation. I know there's some quibble about whether we've double counted some things. And there is, I have to acknowledge in our chart, the Daubert filing was indeed made under the wrong case number. It was timely made. My apologies for that. That's the seventh violation. But there were at least three or four. And another violation certainly was his failure to bring any documents to the deposition. If he's not going to show up, which in and of itself is a violation of two court orders, but his counsel's there, he at least could say, I saw these deuces tecum requests. Here's our best effort at compliance. Here's some documents. And some of the documents we were requesting were completely vanilla things like, if you have any professional certificates, bring them. We asked request number 12 and 13, please produce to us at the deposition the documents you have already given to your expert 5 years ago, who testified in your behalf at the evidentiary hearing, who said, I've looked at some of Mr. Lopez's internal financial papers and the corporate records. We said, well, if you've sent them to your expert, the lawyers presumably have them, or your expert saw them 5 years ago, give them to us so we can know what these are. They didn't even bring those. So there wasn't even a good faith accommodation. And Judge Jordan, I heard yesterday, I was listening to the oral arguments, you had a case with the lawyer regulation. And you said, you know, this would be a different story if the lawyer had attempted to produce some evidence or made some good faith effort to produce something. Instead, he just totally stonewalled. Well, that's what we have here. That's another violation of Judge Scola's order. He produces nothing in paper discovery, doesn't even interpose an objection. So just nothing, complete defiance. Now, Judge Jordan, I promised you that I would get back to the FDD stuff, and I want to keep my word.
Before you get there, I just do want to make it clear that you view that as an alternative ruling, so we don't have to reach it if we don't want to.
That is exactly right. And in fact, docket entry 536, this is Judge Scola's default order at pages 2, 3, and footnote 1. Judge Scola says exactly that point. So this isn't just my opinion. Judge Scola says, I had alternate bases for my holdings, denying the motions for protective order, not just the FDD, and either one is independently sufficient. That's Judge Scola saying that, not just me. So yes, that is correct. I don't think you need to, and frankly, I don't think you should. There's a lot of pragmatic reasons why you ought not. If you do reach the fugitive disentitlement doctrine, which I don't think you need to, and I don't think you should, the basis on which you ought to decide it is the statutory basis, not the equitable common law basis that Judge Jordan, we all discussed 2 years ago with Chief Judge Pryor and the panel, because in the intervening time, there has been a new Florida statute. We notified the court the day that statute was enacted. It's 772.12 subsection 6. We sent a Rule 28J letter the day Florida enacted that provision and the governor signed it into law. It's been 7 months since then. Not a single word from the appellant. Now, Rule 28J says you get the right to respond promptly. There has been 7 months he hasn't said anything. He hasn't asked for supplemental briefing on the question. Just complete silence. It's a concession by silence that he no longer has this right as a matter of Florida law. Judge Jordan, when you wrote the opinion for the panel 2 years ago saying he gets a jury trial, the basis for that was Florida Statute 7708. It's a statutory right to a jury trial. That has now been superseded by Florida statute, the new Florida statute. So he no longer has the right to a jury trial. That's Section 6A1 of the statute. But more to the point.
The full citation to that statute?
Absolutely. It's Florida Statute 772.12, subsection 6. And we filed a notice of supplemental authority on June 20th of last year, 7 months ago. The day was passed. Section 6A2 of that statute is a statutory fugitive disentitlement doctrine. And it says you cannot, quote, use the resources of the court, et cetera, if you're a fugitive. And it says, including in post-execution proceedings, the statute also says it applies to already existing cases, so there's a retroactivity provision. It's the whole ballgame. He has no answer for it. It's as if we never even filed the 28J letter, because he has no response to it. So if you do have to reach the FDD, which I don't think you do, and I don't think you should, resolve it on the statutory basis as a matter of positive enactment of law, from the Florida legislature, not the common law equitable doctrine, which I acknowledge is amorphous. And we had talked about this 2 years ago, Judge Jordan, about how there's some tension in this court's decisions between the Pessin case and the Farron case. One of them says you can't use the FDD to bar a civil defendant. The other one says you can. That one was up on appeal. I think one of the distinguishing factors between those two cases is that the Pessin case, the one that's in our favor, denied the ability to appeal, not just defend in the trial court. And Judge Scola, if you notice in one of his orders, I believe it's 536, emphasized that word appeal in Pessin, that maybe you can't apply it at the district court, but certainly a court of appeals can bar a litigant who has lost from appealing if he's a fugitive. I leave that to this court's discretion on how to deal with it, but I don't think you even have to go there. It's a mess. We think we get the better of those arguments between Pessin and Farron, but you never even have to get to that point. There's one other point I want to make about the deposition, how he was supposed to know it was coming. And Judge Jordan, you're exactly right. When you sent this thing back for a jury trial, he had to know. He was the key star witness. After all, we have to prove that he's an agency or instrumentality of a terrorist party. And so, of course, we're going to depose him. And Your Honor's order in 2022 even alluded to that in footnote 8 of the opinion. If you look at the Stancil 2022 opinion, footnote 8, you say for the court, Judge Jordan, look, we know we have this affidavit. It was for an evidentiary hearing, and he didn't show up. It might have been a different story. This will get him past summary judgment or de facto summary judgment under the Florida statute to the jury trial right, which existed then, does not exist now. But you said it might have been a different story if there had been reciprocal discovery. And obviously, that's what was coming. when we go to a jury trial, when you said we should have a jury trial, you didn't say we should have a jury trial by ambush, where we don't know what his defense is going to be, where he's going to show up and say he's a quote-unquote legitimate, innocent billionaire businessman from Venezuela, but we can't look at any of his corporate documents. We can't ask him any questions about how he made his billions. Of course we have to ask those questions. He knew the deposition was coming. So there is no legitimate excuse for not sitting for the deposition. There is no legitimate excuse for failing to produce even a single document in discovery or even interposing a specific objection to a discovery request. Nothing. So unless your honors have additional questions, I'll sit down and reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Let's start first with the new Florida statute. It's unconstitutional. We've challenged it in the Marone case. And in fact, one judge in this district has already found that the application in a situation just like ours would be unconstitutional because it would violate his due process rights. One of the main reasons it's unconstitutional is because it has no limiting principle connecting the case for which you're a fugitive to the current case. And that's critical because that was one of the issues also at issue at this case. And the judge erred. He was invited to error by made false statements. But there are false statements in the record that caused the judge even to think that the fugitive disentitlement doctrine applies here. He says,
Counselor, I do appreciate, and we need to hear more about the FDD, but just quickly, assuming that we leave the FDD issue alone, what are you asking us to do? We vacate and remand the default, you go back, you make what sounds like the same arguments and multiple motions, and then what?
There's a simple solution, Your Honor. If the judge doesn't invoke the fugitive disentitlement doctrine in this plainly unconstitutional way, and gives us 33 weeks, which is the standard expedited. If that's what he wants for a discovery, that's a reasonable period of time to have discovery, we're all for that. That's what we're asking for.
And we're all for that. You all for that, meaning that if the deposition is required, your client will then comply.
As long as he can comply on video as he was ordered before.
With the conditions that your client has set.
Well, I think that was a condition that the court itself unilaterally set. We didn't ask for it, but
she doesn't mean that. She means other conditions that you or your client might set for his appearance.
All we're asking is just to be treated like any other litigant, and that is the essence of the fugitive.
If this goes back, let's assume you win across the board. It goes back. Judge Gola gets it. Says, Bello, forget the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. I may have been a little bit too hasty in pulling that trigger. The 11th Circuit thought so. I have it back now. 2 weeks, you're sitting for a Zoom deposition. Does he sit?
Is there a subpoena duces tecum, so he has to push all these documents through and all within 2 weeks? We'll make
let's
it happen.
Let's take it the easy way. Mm-hmm. No subpoena duces tecum.
Yes. You
sit for a deposition 2 weeks from now. You're not getting your 33 weeks of discovery. I'm expediting this thing. You've been on notice for a while that you were going to be deposed. You can do it by Zoom. 2 weeks.
Yes. And as long as
our objection is going to be filed to the deposition?
Our objection is going to be filed to
yes.
the deposition itself?
Yes.
As long as he can appear by Zoom?
No,
as long
that's,
as he is,
that's part
as long
of my question. The
ability, like any other litigant, to make objections.
Will there be objections to the sitting for a deposition?
No.
None whatsoever.
If as long as he is able.
The order just says, Mr. Lopez.
Right.
2 weeks from now, you will sit for a Zoom deposition. 9 o'clock on this date. Will there be any motions filed by you on his behalf to prevent that deposition from happening or from delaying it in any way?
No, Your Honor.
None.
Again. None. And again, as so long as he can make the objections, be able to file motions and not be...
No. I just asked you about motions.
Well, the question is if the court is on remand saying, I cannot impose the fugitive disentitlement doctrine, so
he
I just, will consider...
He gives you an order. Okay, you have to listen to my hypothetical.
Okay.
He says, no fugitive disentitlement doctrine reliance of any kind. They've asked for discovery. I've already said I'm granting reciprocal discovery. Mr. Lopez, you're sitting for a deposition in 2 weeks by Zoom.
Then he will sit, Your Honor.
You're not going to seek any affirmative relief to prevent the deposition from going forward.
We would not, Your Honor.
Okay.
And this is all what we're talking about is we just need to have a fair shake. We can't be treated in an order like you see here where one party, you're barred from filing motions, but the other party, please file motions if you're not satisfied with what the other party does. That is not an even playing field. That is not litigation. It's not consistent with due process. It's not consistent with the First Amendment. I do want to make another point. We did pose specific objections that the judge did not consider. It's in the record. I also want to point out that there really is no alternative basis because all the alternative bases are all incorrect or they are based on essentially not even considering the motion. That is the critical
aspect. Didn't Judge Scola rule alternatively on at least some of your objections and deny them on the merits? For example, your objection that his previous orders didn't contemplate discovery.
And
he says, no, I think you're mistaken. My orders may not have been explicit on the point, but they did contemplate discovery.
Problem,
so you're wrong on that point, denied.
Well, the problem is that decision is not consistent with the rules, which would require him.
That just means that it's wrong. That doesn't mean it wasn't considered.
Well, if it's right? Okay, but if it's a basis that is wrong and it's obviously so, then it can't be an adequate independent grounds.
I agree with that, but it's different than saying he didn't consider.
He considered some,
okay.
But again, the last order, which is the most problematic one, is the one where he doesn't consider. And he basically says, I'm just not considering. That's the one that triggered the appeal. I do want to raise a couple of other important issues. I mentioned before.
You've got to wrap up because you're beyond your time. And I know we've taken you partly beyond it, but you have a minute to wrap up.
I want to, just to wrap up, this was an abuse of discretion. You look back at the original condition that set all of this off, which is the invocation of the Fugitive Disentitlement Doctrine. It is only one violation. There may have been two orders, but he only violated it once. There was no bad faith. And the reason that there was no bad faith, among other things, is that you have both a belief that this court the lower court has no jurisdiction to enforce an order that's unconstitutional. It's essentially a void order. We can't file motions. The court acknowledged this was at least a close call, asked for additional briefing on whether or not this was an injunction. I know they went the other way, but we acted in good faith in trying to preserve our appeal, given all the prior threats that the lower court had made that if we filed any more motions, we'd be sanctioned. We were stuck in an impossible situation. The only way to preserve his rights, keep them from being mooted, was to come to Your Honor. The other reason that this is, again, an abuse of discretion, and I'll wrap up, again, this was a sua sponte Rule 37. They never asked for a Rule 37 motion to compel. We never even had an opportunity to respond. The last filing was a reply brief to a different set of reliefs. For us to even file a surreply, we would have had to file a motion to file a surreply in the court, which again would have been in violation of his order because he says
that's not exactly right because you're responding to a request for relief by the other side. That's a defensive motion, not an affirmative motion.
All of our motions essentially would have been affirmative motions the way he was characterizing it. If we asked for even just a motion for protective order because we're defending ourselves from discovery violations that the plaintiffs are doing, that's still a defensive motion. The idea of affirmative relief is very clear in the law. It's, do I have a separate claim? In fact, Farron uses that term, claim. That means it's an independent claim that I can bring a counterclaim, for example. So the court was completely in error by focusing on affirmative relief. We never sought any affirmative relief anywhere in this proceeding. The only thing we tried to do was defend ourselves. And just one other point, because I do want to address this whole issue about what kind of precedent does this set? And I would counsel Your Honors, what kind of precedent does it set that you have an order that essentially prevents one of the litigants from defending themselves? It will create the exact same scenario that was hypothesized by this court in Farron, that you'd have a plaintiff who would take advantage of the situation because they know that you have another side that won't defend themselves. So that's what we're asking. We're just asking for reversal and remand so that we can argue this case, we can file whatever motions, we can submit objections, and we'll be heard just like any other litigant. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much.